discovery that perhaps divination and canon exegesis might have something of a relationship is more than 10 years old. When I was working on the Chunjo Gongyang Chuan, I all of a sudden thought that there might be something like a divinatory hermeneutics to it. And I have discussed that in a reading session where several people have taken part and we have discussed this idea. And the next step then was for me to extend this idea to the other classics as well and to think about it more broadly. What actually is the relationship between canon exegesis and divinatory interpretation, divinatory reading? What kind of reading expertise and interpretation expertise has come out of early and sophisticated divinatory traditions of specialists reading texts, like heavenly texts, like textures of animals, of animal behavior, even of human faces and of the physiognomy of horses, right? So so there is this expertise out there, and then there is the beginning of an expertise of text reading, and I thought that there might be some relationship here. So I pursued this idea, and I would like to present you some of my results and some of the things which I found. Today I would like to start with looking at the Near East, first of all, because when I was looking for comparisons as a kind of check whether this as a cultural theory hypothesis is sort of rational at all, I was thinking that we do have similar long-standing divinatory expertise and traditions in the Near East, in Egypt, in Mesopotamia, and then we have an exegesis which starts on texts which however are a little bit different in nature, which are texts of prophets, texts of the old Hebrew tradition, and there might be some correspondence here. So what I will do today is I would like to start with looking at the Near East and some developments in terms of divination and exegesis, and from there establish a model and perhaps an analytical frame to then look at China and see what can be said of China so far. So when we are mapping different methods of divination, it has become customary, and you might have heard often about this distinction, to break them down into two categories. There is this basic distinction into inductive methods that involve the interpretation of signs and omens by observing physical objects, right? And this applies to astrology, bird divination, inspection of inner organs of animal like liver, lungs, and heart. This is called ectispsy, right? And clouds, looking at clouds, physiognomies, and so on. And then the second is non-inductive or intuitive methods such as dreams and visions and prophecy. In the first category, a specialist actively applies a technique which he has been trained in. The emphasis is on the cognitive process of finding out the right interpretation of these kind of what I would broadly call and generally call texts or textures. In contrast, inspiration or possession are seen as typical of the second category. The message is mostly understood by the person who not necessarily is a specialist. So this distinction between technical and non-technical divination is often traced back to Plato's Phaedrus, where Socrates makes the difference between the divinely inspired knowledge based on mania, madness, and the divinatory techne based on observation and calculation. Socrates is strongly in favor of mania, as this is divinely inspired and therefore superior to a human activity such as the divinatory techniques. Cicero, who was aware of Plato's distinction, has himself made a similar distinction in his famous work, De Divinatione, between artificial and natural divination. The former is so-called because the science with which it is occupied requires specialized expertise to interpret, so this would be artificial, while the natural division relies on things like inspired utterances and dreams which naturally come to you insofar as spirits, demons, or gods are natural. Cicero's distinction, which is cited everywhere in works on divination, has had a considerable influence on the modern concept of divination. A similar dichotomy between prophecy and divination can be found in the Hebrew Bible. Here, prophecy, including visions and dreams, is clearly the privileged way of God's communication with humans, while other forms of divination are generally condemned. In the Greek context, the distinctions are not as clear-cut. The titles prophetes, mantis, and promantis are used of practitioners of divination of both types, which suggests that Greek, Socrates notwithstanding, did not necessarily classify divination according to the Platonian technical and non-technical divide. So there seems to be some kind of general consensus here about these basic categorizations. However, of course, there is a lot of critique to it, and we do have problems in clearly classifying all kinds of divinatory methods. For example, if you look at ecstatic practices, which people like Iliade would like to call shamanism, you do have techniques here, which, however, are body techniques, and which require, of course, initiations, require training, education, and so on and so forth, to then become possessed, right? And then to receive visions. Now let me explain this difference in more detail by looking at concrete historical examples. Seth Richardson has defined a set of features that he found characteristic of ecstispicy, so this liver reading and animal organs reading, and which also apply to other techniques of divination. So there is a systematic organization of phenomena in correlative systems, causal association to other repeatable phenomena, creation of extensible theoretical categories, and empirical method in the employment of observation. I would like now to make a very schematic sort of table between features which could either be put on the prophetical or on the divinatory side, and would like to summarize as follows. The prophets were not versed in secret law in written form. Most of them were probably illiterate, so they couldn't read. Their education and knowledge must have been of totally different kind than that of the practitioners of divinatory techniques. Prophetic messages were predominantly verbal messages that were believed to be of divine origin. They were mostly clear and had not to be decoded, as they did not pose understanding difficulties to the one who received them. The prophetic techniques, and here Plato might be wrong, as these are also techniques, even though techniques of the body. So these techniques probably included achieving the altered state of consciousness that enabled them to act as mouthpieces of the divine. Perhaps something akin to what anthropologists classify as shamanism, which Iliade has defined as archaic techniques of ecstasy. The prophetic messages were more often than not accompanied by characteristic behavior that served as their identity marker and a cultural signifier that made it possible for the audience to acknowledge their performance as prophecies. Prophecies, in turn, have to be regarded as performances, and prophecy perhaps as an art. We will come back to this important point later. Such mad behavior, called mania by Socrates, was evidently not expected of diviners, who represented rather the scholarly type of rational behavior. Another feature that sets the prophets apart from the diviners is their social location. While the prophets regularly communicate with kings in the Mesopotamian, West Semitic, Biblical, and Greek sources, the prophets, while the diviners regularly communicate with the kings, the prophets usually seem not to have belonged to the innermost circle of kings, who mostly were informed of their saying through go-betweens. This is not to say that prophets represented a marginalized group or that the political agency was insignificant. However, the communication between kings and the prophets is clearly not as intensive as that between the kings and their diviner scholars, who often had high positions at the court or outside and divined any important event. So these people are institutionalized in royal institutions, whereas the prophets normally are not. The Hebrew Bible is a slight exception. Kings and prophets get together more than anywhere else, despite their recurrent conflicts. Moreover, prophets seem to come from different backgrounds. This would be another distinctive feature. We do find slave girls uttering prophecies. And this is another distinct feature. Whereas diviners are always male, women, children, and gender-neutral persons, called asinu in Mesopotamia, were often chosen as prophets. Now, this is a little different in Greece, where we also find female seers who also practice technical divination. Now, due to their low social class, uncertain education background, prophets constantly had to deal with the problem of credibility. We know of many false prophets, but false diviners are not a great topic in the literature. The typical venue for prophetic performance is the temple, whereas diviners are often associated with the imperial institutions, either at court or outside, at observation stations. A final and, for my research, most important difference between prophecy and omen divination is that prophecy is basically an oral performance that neither presupposed written texts nor necessarily ever took a written form. We will see how this slowly changed in the late Second Temple period, in the 2nd and 1st century BCE, and how, with the textualization of prophecy in the book Daniel and the Pesharim commentaries, found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, the difference between prophecy and omen divination begins to reduce in the tradition of the Hebrew Bible. Now, if we look at this list, it really looks like a yin-yang list, right? Male, female, low status, high status, rational, irrational, mad, normal, sorry. This was not meant to be said. Art, science, and so on. So you have the typical twofold division here, and I find that quite interesting, and it is it very much smells like a construction, right? So so we should be attentive here to look at how these roles are constructed in the literature and what exactly they want to say. Now, we have plenty of evidence of technical divination in Mesopotamia. Like in ancient Egypt, divination manuals and huge collection of omen series have been archived and purport detailed information about techniques, topics, sociology, and politics of divinatory practices. In contrast, we find very little evidence on prophetical traditions in the sources. Those few evidences, which are scarcely spread over sources of different times and locations, mainly in letters excavated from the Royal Archive of Mari, 18th century BCE, and the Royal Library of Nineveh, 7th century BCE, show that prophets existed and had most of the features which we also know from the Israelite prophets. They belonged to a low social class, included women, were called ecstatic speakers, oracle priests, seers, and even Nabi, which is the biblical word for prophet. The fact that most of the information on prophets were transmitted in letters indicates that it was predominantly also an oral tradition, which, however, was not important enough to be included in historical reports. Nögel notes the fact that in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, divinatory techniques were clearly the dominant written traditions of coping with the future, whereas the Israelites appear to have reserved the performative power of the written word for prophecy by dreams and texts perceived as authored by Yahweh. He explains this distinction by referring to the generative role of script in shaping Near Eastern conception of the divine sign. The cuneiform and hieroglyphic writing systems of Mesopotamia and Egypt both have a large repertoire of signs with polyvalent logographic and determinative values. The Israelites, with their consonantal script, appear something of an anomaly, whereas the Bible's Ten Commandments explicitly prohibit the creation of images and magical praxis, and divination is rejected in the legal code of the Bible. The Bible demands the transmission of divine knowledge by way of spoken and written word. Yet, in contrast to Egyptian and Mesopotamian interpretations of their writing, which makes abundant use of punning hermeneutics, the Israelites' associative dimension was limited largely to sound devices. According to Nögel, they therefore placed a greater emphasis on orality in the interpretative process. The creation of the world, for example, is a purely oral work. In Mesopotamia and Egypt, performative power was centered in the divine sign and script and was activated by the professional during the process of speaking, writing, and decoding. Israel inclined toward oral modes of performative power, which naturally centered the locus of power more firmly on the speaker, not so much on the text, and on the direct situation of communication and not of decoding an object on the other, silent object on the other side. Consequently, an Israelite could embody the same performative power that a cuneiform or hieroglyphic sign could in Mesopotamia and Egypt. So persons in this process would have a different role than in the divinatory traditions. And this, of course, might be one of the reasons why these conflict with monarchs would arise. There is a sort of authority which is not controllable and which is out of any framework of legitimation other than the received message, which is purported by the person herself. Looking at the different forms of interpretations of the divine messages, divinatory models of explanation mostly operated within the framework of the lemma plus comment method. So classical omen texts, and this is sort of general knowledge in Assyriology. Classical omen texts are generally comprised of what Assyriologists call a protasis, representing an observable phenomenon, and an apodosis, which supplies the explanation of the omen. For example, if there are many crazy men in the city, this is the protasis, the city is well. Right? This is the explanation of the observed phenomenon. The logic of these statements is the modus ponens, which is defined by its form. If P, then Q, or P, therefore Q. Explanations mainly aim at revealing the hidden relationship between the protasis and the apodosis. Punning and wordplay often function as the hermeneutical bridge between the protasis and the apodosis. Sometimes analogy or authority from precedent is used. So we have the protasis and the apodosis, and what the commentaries normally do is to explain and to give the issue of this relationship. Yeah? Why is it good if there are many crazy men in the city? And then they use methods of identification sometimes. And this might be on the formal level that they look at similar sounds, right? For example, onomastic explanations or analogies. They say, well, this is actually analogous to the other one. So these would be formal explanations on the formal level of the text. And in this respect, we have lots of wordplay in these mantic omen commentaries. Commentaries on prophetic texts work rather differently. Until the 2nd century BCE, any kind of prophecies are commented and adapted to new contexts, not by commenting them, but by rewriting them. In rewritten texts, the exegete appropriates the language and form of the base text in such a way that the new composition both updates the base text and at the same time it blurs the distinction between the base text and its interpretation. This kind of exegesis follows the logic of inspiration, I would think. As the prophetical texts are not regarded as encoded scripts, there is no need to apply complicated exegetical techniques to a fixed text, which has to be preserved in its original form. This, however, changes in the 2nd century BCE, when the base text has gone such an authoritative status that its textual form achieves an inviolate status. As noted above, rewritten scriptural texts intrude into the base text in such a way that the lines between text and interpretation are blurred. In contrast, the fundamental characteristic of a commentary is that the base text is unadulterated and the distinction between text and interpretation is clearly marked. So this rewriting is quite an interesting phenomenon because we do have records of visions or of dreams, for example, in old Mesopotamian sources, and There is, for example, the example of one of these visions, which has been reported by three different people or in three different letters, and it's clearly visible that this is the same vision, but it's put very differently in very different texts. Right? So the formulation and the report of these omina is never the revealed text itself. It's always a report on a vision. And this is why the status of these reports is never gains this same formal authority that it has to be kept word by word, because this is the revealed text. Instead, we find a rewriting, right, to adapt these texts to new situation, to make them applicable to new situations. And this is very different from a text which is revealed either in itself or which is a textra, revealed as an omen or whatever, where the form has to be decoded, and it is the form which has to be kept, because the form has the meaning, right? And it's not the reported meaning, which then, of course, can be rewritten to be explained by rewriting it and not by commenting upon the report, the form of the report, how it has been put, because the reporter never has the same authority as the text itself. And this is different. This is different in the case of texts which are commented and which come from the divinatory traditions and which have therefore a much higher authority. Now, the turn to commentary in the tradition of prophetic text is tied to the march toward canon and the increasing rigidity of the scriptural text. This is most clearly visible in the book of Daniel and in a kind of commentary called Pesharim, a collection of 17 previously unknown commentaries on scriptural prophetic books. Several formal and exegetical features unite these 17 manuscripts. The ideological basis of the Pesharim is the assumption that the ancient prophetic words do not refer to the specific points in time in which they were uttered. Rather, the words of the prophets are hidden ciphers that allude to the historical circumstances and eschatological expectations of the community of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other Jews and foreigners within its orbit. So these Pesharim have been found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they try to explain prophetical texts from the Bible. One Habakkuk commentary is especially famous. And this is, we could say, the kind of transition between prophetic texts which are rewritten and then all of a sudden a canonization of texts which are all of a sudden viewed as something which hides its true meaning, which becomes fixed and therefore has a commentary has to be added to it. The book of Daniel represents an important bridge between the Near Eastern evidence and the Pesharim. It makes not only use of exactly the same formula of protasis and the apodosis by repeating and lemmatizing the parts of his visions or dreams as protasis, which he then explains in an apodosis. Right? So you have his dreams, and then he first of all reports his dreams, and then he repeats like line by line and gives an explanation to it in the book of Daniel. This is very interesting to see. So he lemmatizes certain parts, separate selected parts, and then gives a commentarial explanation to it. And this is similar to the dream vision of Josephus in Egypt and so on and so forth. So these are ways of reporting dream omina, which then are used also to explain prophetic visions. It further makes full use of exactly the same technical exegetical terms which are used in Near East dream and omen exegesis. And I'm not a specialist in that, I fully rely on the secondary literature here, but there are technical terms and technical ways how to put commentary to an omen and how to explain it, and exactly the same literary form and the same technical terminology is used in these commentaries of Pesharim and in Daniel. In Daniel, dreams and visions are increasingly associated with writing and Daniel's scribal identity. Daniel is introduced as knowledgeable in all writings and wisdom and of visions and dreams of all kinds. So we can see how a new kind of scholar prophet is created who, as in Daniel 7, writes down the vision that is in need for interpretation. So instead of reporting it, he first writes it down, then comments upon the text. So the text becomes quite important here. Similarly, the writing on the wall omen interpreted by Daniel differs from the observable omens more commonly found in Near Eastern omen literature. The writing on the wall is presented as the observable phenomenon in written form. Here, for the first and probably only time, we have a prophecy in form of a text that in turn is interpreted by Daniel in much the same way as other omens in Near Eastern omen texts. Yassin analyzes how Daniel, following a technical introductory formula familiar from omen texts, lemmatizes each aspect of text and explicates its meaning. Each individual element in the written omen is provided with a new meaning, as in the dreams and visions, wordplay functions as an important hermeneutical bridge from the lemma to interpretation. Quote end. I would like to add an observation here. The particular form of textualization which make use of mantic interpretation techniques show a preference to all kinds of wordplay. This builds on an old discussion regarding the twofold nature of language that has been conducted since thousands of years in different parts of the world. On the one hand, language signifies meaning. On the other, it embodies meaning by using visual or phonetic forms of expressions. Now, the relation and mutual dependency between content and body, as well as between the meaning and form of language, have been much discussed by early philosophers, whether in Platon's Cratulus or in Gongsun Long's Ming Shi Lun. The question whether words are conventional arbitrary signs or do have a natural intrinsic relation to the things they signify has been posed early on in Chinese and Western traditions. Now, due to this split between signifier and signified, language has been declared as deficient mode of expressing reality in many early cultures. Consequently, various techniques of textual enhancement have been developed to bridge this gap for playful entertainment, to provoke the efficacy of words, or enrich textual meaning with greater density or complexity. Literary techniques of textual enhancement appear in manifold forms. So we have technopaenia in all its variants of acrostics, anagrams, pangrams, palindromes, lipograms, isopsephic lines, and various other kinds of letter play, such as the plintides, have precursors in ancient Greece, Egypt, and Babylon. Concrete or visual poetry, including calligrams, carmina figurata, micrography, pattern poems, ambigrams, palindromes, word squares, and many other literary figures playing with language can also be traced back to early literatures. Such literary figures can fulfill different functions, and in most cases they serve several functions at the same time. They can be used for pleasure as literary forms of entertainment, as riddles, or for their aesthetic value of literary embellishment, folkloristic ornament, or poetic effect. They can serve magical purposes in the form of formulas and spells, as they purport an additional hidden meaning which mirrors the invisible body of numinous powers, and so they enhance the mysterious efficacy of the text. Moreover, such figures can be used to hide certain meanings, either because of theological assumptions, as reflected in early theories of manifold senses of scripture, or for purposes of safety in times of persecution. Literary forms can support and further illustrate the contents they purport to reinforce the content by enactment. Such figures can also have argumentative functions when they provide patterns which illuminate the structure and the meaning of an argumentative text. Yet, the attempt to enrich the text by playing with words and identifying signifier and signifiers seems to go hand in hand with a reading that concentrates on the form of the text as something that has its own fixed meaning. This is a typical feature of mantic readings. Nögel has described divination as an act of performance. In the process of divinatory textualization, this has an impact on divinatory texts as they carry elements of performance in their literary form, which reveal some of their hidden contents. Looking at the composition of Daniel is therefore quite instructive, of the book of Daniel, as it demonstrates this specific approach to mantic textuality. So this has been interpreted form, we have the book of Daniel in two different Further hidden structures of what is going on, actually. Right? So the text itself becomes something of a mantic structure or a mantic pattern. This just came to mind, and therefore I show it to you. We have similar literary figures in early Chinese texts, which are written around the same time, right? Also 2nd century BCE, 3rd, 2nd century BCE, and we also have these very strict parallelisms everywhere. But certain things are related to each other. We have the parallelism here, which is clearly marked here, and here, two parallelisms. Yet, there's a parallelism here, which all of a sudden relates these two things together, and here, right, and the parallelism here, and here. So there are parallelisms everywhere. And although these two parts do not necessarily in terms of content, have anything to do with each other, I don't give a because I don't want to go too deep into that. But these two things are two hypotheses which do not necessarily have a relationship in terms of content, but the form shows that they have to be seen as two parallel statements and that they belong together and that there are two aspects of one and the same thing. Right? So again, on the formal level of the text here, we have something like additional information, an additional argumentative evidence. Right? So this I found quite interesting. And we have the similar thing in Daniel, and I would think that probably we do not have this kind of forms of composition in earlier prophecies, which are not so textual, right? But which are much more narrative and so on and so forth. Now, perhaps before you read all that, I go back here first. The evidence from Daniel reflects a broader set of transformations occurring in both the Near Eastern and Jewish worlds. These particular passages are representative of the new literary setting for dream interpretation, divination, and prophecy. Yassin, Nissen, and others have shown how in the Pesharim this kind of omen exegesis is applied in an even more obvious way to other prophetic texts of the Hebrew Bible. Yassin concludes, quote, put in broader perspective the formal and structural similarities between the interpretation of dreams, visions, and omens in Daniel 2, 4, 5, 7, the interpretation of an authoritative text in Daniel 9, and the interpretation of prophetic text in Pesharim offer further evidence of the shared reliance of all these texts on ancient Near Eastern dream and omen interpretation. It represents an interrelated link in the transition from the interpretation of dreams and omens to the interpretation of authoritative text. A similar point can be made for later Agadic and biblical exegesis, which take over mantic practices to adapt biblical texts into new context. Liebermann has in the 1950s already identified similar formula in five Agadic rules out of 32, but he took these five as examples, and mantic practices, and Tigai has provided further evidence for this. The definition of several senses of scripture by Origen in the 2nd century CE, who built on earlier Greek exegetical traditions of allegoresis in interpretations of Homer, has defined the basis for an exegetical tradition that developed the doctrine of the fourfold sense of scripture, which was used until the late Middle Ages and heavily systematized, and as all the Middle Age historians will know, was one of the dominant ways of reading the Bible. A question which I still have to explore in relation to the Near East traditions is whether the textual traditions which adopted divinatory techniques of readings have finally replaced the earlier divinatory traditions on an elite level of scholarly institutions, and if so, how this process took place and whether the adoption of divinatory techniques plays any decisive role in it. So this would be a question which I would pose from the Chinese side to the Near Eastern side, So I think we can sort of pose question in both directions. The Eastern side provides us with such rich material which allows us to make much more differentiated hypotheses also for the Chinese case, and this is due to the huge libraries and archives which have been found in the Near East, in Nineveh and so on, where we have really thousands and tens of thousands of cuneiform texts, including letters, which are a wonderful genre, which we don't have from early China, right? Not so early, at least. And so we do have oracle bone inscriptions and bronze inscriptions and so on, but we don't have the same abundance of material for this very early period, so it is very informative for us. On the other hand side, perhaps we have some historical processes which are then better recorded, later processes which are better recorded on the Chinese side, as we have wonderful source material on the side of historical records and so on. Now, after this tour de force through early Mesopotamian and Israelite divinatory and prophetic texts and text exegesis, I would like to turn to early China and take this first part as a basis for cultural comparison. My aim is to prove my hypothesis that a similar application of divinatory hermeneutics into text exegesis took place in China too. It happened as a result of the fixation of text corpora and the divinization of sages in the 3rd and 2nd century BC. This is what I think. I want to demonstrate that early commentaries to Confucian texts took divinatory texts as their hermeneutics as model, and accordingly followed basic assumptions about text, author, and interpretation from divinatory practices. We might even go so far as to assert that the institutional function of the Confucian classics came to replace the institutional function of divination. And this is where my question to the Near East comes from. I was therefore quite excited to see all this evidence of transformatory stages from divinatory hermeneutics to textual exegesis in the rich material from the Near East, which allows a much more differentiated analysis of this process. I will therefore also base my own analysis on the terminology and categories established above in my analysis of the Chinese material. In the division between the prophetic and divinatory traditions of the Near East, China clearly falls on the side of divination. It is surprising how many features of early China are identical with the traditions of Egypt and Mesopotamia. First, China's script is similar to the cuneiform and hieroglyphic scripts in that its characters consist of phonetic and determinative elements and allow a similar great range of operations with phonetic and graphical elements. Punning hermeneutics, wordplay, and the creation of ambiguity can be found all over the place in early Chinese texts and commentaries. And many of the techniques of meaning production are, in fact, identical. We had lots of interesting hours with Egyptologists and Assyrologists comparing these textual techniques on the level of wordplay, and it is quite stunning to see how many similar techniques have been used in China, in Egypt, and in Mesopotamia, with a very similar structure of characters, right? Which of course the alphabet does not allow in the same way. Second, prophetic traditions are existent in the form of mediums, which are very often translated as shamans, right? Wu, so-called Wu or the Xi. If they are male, they are Xi. If they are female, they are Wu. So this is what the Guoyu says. So we do have female shamans as well. So this is another feature. So in the Guoyu, in the Chu Yuxia division, there is a passage which reconstructs the process whereby these prophets lost their function and positions in China. This process imagined to have taken place in the mythical age of the five emperors, in the 3rd millennium BCE perhaps, is remembered as pervasion between heaven and earth. And I quote the Guoyu, "Anciently the people did not intermingle with the spirits. Among the people there were some who were of such a refined brightness and single-mindedness that they were reverent and truly decent. Their wisdom enabled them to collate that what lies above and below. Their sageliness enabled them to illumine what is distant and pervade, what is bright. Their perspicaciousness enabled them to illuminate it, and their savvy enabled them to understand it thoroughly. Bright spirits would descend upon such people, of which males were called he shamans and females wu shamanesses. They arranged the positions and sequential orders of the spirits at the ceremonies, made the sacrificial vessels serve them in timely response, and thereupon brought about a situation in which the posterity of the sage kings had brilliance and were able to know all the ritual rules of how to conduct proper religious services. Thereupon, institutions relating to heaven and earth, spirits and people, and all classifiable categories called the five offices came into being, each taking charge of their distinctive duties so that no disorder occurred among them. People and spirits had different tasks. They respected each other and did not interfere. Therefore, the spirits sent down their blessings and the people comforted them with the right kind of offerings. Natural calamities did not occur, and there was balance in what was needed and what was supplied. When it came to the demise of Shaohao, the nine Li tribes fell into disorder. The people and spirits became intermingled and matters could not be distinguished. Everyone did their own rituals and every family had their own shaman priests. Obligations ceased to exist. The people failed to attend the regular ceremonies and didn't know about their bliss. Instead, their sacrificial offerings were beyond measure, and people and spirits took the same positions. People approached them on an equal level without awe and reverence. Spirits were laxly adopted to the people's standards, and their actions were not extolled. They didn't send down their blessings, and they were not comforted with the right kind of offerings. Natural calamities occurred, and neither side exhausted its full potential. Hence, Zhuan Qu, who followed Shaohao, ordered Chong, the governor of the south, to take charge of the heavenly realm as purely belonging to the spirits, and he ordered Li, the governor of the fire, to take charge of the earthly realm as purely belonging to the people. They brought the two sides back to the old regular norms so that they did not no longer interfere, and this is meant by cutting the pervasion between heaven and earth. Story ends. We do not know very much about these prophets, but a number of features seem to have been identical with the features described for prophets in the Near East. So they had low social positions and no positions at the royal courts. This is from the later sources. They could be male or female and use techniques of ecstasy or possession to work as the mouthpiece of spirits and gods. Like in the Near East, diviners were employed by the royal and later imperial courts, stood in competition against each other, were associated with scholarly secret knowledge and magical techniques, and I also don't know of any female diviner in China. So all of these features seem to be quite similar to what we have seen from the Near East. Although our earliest written sources, the oracle bones from the 14th and 13th century BCE, show the Shang King as the highest priest and diviner, and diviners throughout China's early history held high positions, the history of divination in China is a history of constant decline of the divinatory institution. To explain this decline and the following rise of textual authority, I would like to outline something like a historical background that provides reasons for the marginalization of divinatory texts and the emergence of new text models in the 4th century BC China. My main hypothesis is that between the 9th and the 2nd century BCE, an empiricization of knowledge about the future developed, which took a radical tinge in the 3rd century BCE. I would like to mention two reasons for this development. First, socio-politically, the institutions of coping with the future changed fundamentally. With the loss of the central power of the Zhou dynasty between the 10th and 8th century BCE, the divinatory practice started to become dissociated from the center and dispersed to a number of new local power centers, which emerged and left the divinatory practice to specialists who then further developed divinatory techniques. This led to competition and critique of divinatory techniques, which in turn weakened the institutions. In early sources like the Zhuozhuan, we clearly see how critique is formulated against specific divinatory techniques, against divinatory premises, and eventually also against divination as a whole. At the same time, fundamental changes in the socio-political realm lead to the abolishment of an earlier ritual order and to the development of new techniques of statecraft based on a rationality which impacts on administrative, economic, military, and also divinatory models. As a consequence, knowledge of the past, present, and future increasingly follows empirical evidence with methodological reference of inductive models that refer to historical precedents and cosmological pattern based on observations and new theories about cosmic cycles and linear causal chains. Now, methodologically, the empiricization results from the dynamics of what I regard as a constitutive feature of divination, which I would like to define as follows. Divination is a determination of open spaces which are unknown and of which knowledge has to be gained through decision techniques that are based on clearly defined rules. These open spaces are the driving force of divination, yet they are open and have to be explained. They can be closed by getting access to a knowledge that is hidden in an invisible realm and can be expressed by author agents in divinatory texts that can be interpreted by divination experts. The relevance of divination is based on the degree of tension between these open spaces and the possibility to close these spaces through interpretation. By constantly attempting to close the open spaces and to find more refined methodologies of solving this tension in order to control and calculate the outcome divination, in fact, this process aims at making itself redundant. Now, I perhaps skip the examples which I have, the historical examples which I have, to show this kind of decline of divinatory institutions. I was giving the example of oracle bone divination, first of all, where you have the king himself acting as a high priest, then the eating divination, where the open space is much more controlled, much more than in the very open outcome of a oracle bone divination. We have done that ourselves at the EKGF, so we know how difficult it is to get a response from the spirits, and with him as a master. And so there's a sort of very fundamental unclariness whether or not you would get a response at all, whether the spirits would descend or not. In eating divination, you would always get a response, so the open space is much more controlled, and you have a selection of several 64 different possibilities of answers, so everything is much more systematized and closed. And then in the hemerologies, and I don't know whether or not we should call them divinatory texts, everything is really closed. There is not really an open space because you just have tables and you just correlate things which are going on. There's not really a question which is open and cannot be solved or relies on whatever luck or the ambition of an ancestor or whatever. Now, what I want to illustrate is that the relevance of divination was somehow weakened in a process of what Max Weber perhaps would have called rationalization, and we perhaps would call secularization today. And it might be for this reason that new kinds of texts with open spaces were being created in that time. So the numerous texts in tombs which have been excavated in the last 40 years are good indicators for a period when text reading became more widely spread, gained social importance, and probably raised a considerably broad class of text readers. That is exactly this time, that in exactly this time a movement starts that aims at making ideal texts modeled upon divinatory texts might be due to the fact that the religious assumption underlying divination to this growing class of text readers perhaps have not been convincing anymore. Yet it were the divinatory traditions that had developed the most sophisticated reading strategies in their interpretation of divinatory text, so they couldn't be totally abolished. Now, in order to argue my point clearer when comparing divinatory text with canonical text, I need to define more clearly the main features of divinatory text. Now, divinatory texts, as I shall define them here, include all systems of signs, visual and oral, that are interpreted for prognostication, to infer a meaning that has relevance for those who engage in the divination. Divinatory texts share certain features that are conditional for divinatory practice. So these were the three stages I was talking about earlier, and these are features of divinatory texts. So they convey messages that are believed to be basically true. They are, however, difficult to read, since they employ an obscure language, which is hidden, the meaning is hidden, and a complicated system of signs, therefore, has to be divined. Significant signs that convey meaning are mainly detected as deviations from strictly defined patterns of regularities. They are interpreted as bases of analogies that are either connected through formal or through correlative equivalences. They are produced by author agents such as heaven, gods, or ancestors, which possess authority due to their superior knowledge, which can provide advice and guidance to those who seek for it. The relationship between meaning and text in these divinatory texts is not mediated by an authorial intention, because the divinatory utterances are in most cases provoked by specific divination techniques, such as heating of bones or dividing and counting bundles of yarrow stalks and so on, which force the author agents to respond. The authorial act of expressing a hidden meaning thus does not follow an intention, but is a direct and choiceless mirroring of the truth of which they possess knowledge. The only given choice on the side of heaven, gods, or ancestors is to not respond to a divinatory ritual, but once there is a response, there is no choice in the response other than to reveal the truth as obscure as it might appear. So I've never heard of a response which is a lie, right? So this is an interesting feature. The relationship is therefore what I want to call a physiognomical one. This means that the expression is not mediated by an intention, but immediately reveals the truth of something otherwise invisible. In early Chinese divination, an intention is only assumed if signs are considered to be sent by heaven, ghosts, or ancestors without being provoked by humans. In these cases, however, we can detect, so like we often have in Shangshu and so on, in these cases, however, we can detect a historical development from anthropomorphic and personal imaginations of an unpredictable and uncontrollable will or intention to more regulated and depersonalized forms of actions, such as the more mechanist ideas of omina and prodigies produced by effects of more abstract forces like yin-yang, wu-xing, or the heavenly stems and the earthly cycles of the hemerological text. Since in these regulated systems there is no space for personal intention, the relationship between meaning and divinatory text is, like in the case of the provoked signs, a physiognomical one, and the only intention is to give expression to an overall prevailing order. Now, it is the access to the superior knowledge of the author agent that makes divinatory text as mediators of this knowledge so relevant to humans, because this superior knowledge helps them to arrive at decisions that alter their fates towards the better. Like sages have to be constructed as models to be followed, texts also have to be constructed as sagely and as canonical texts. The systematic making of ideal canonical texts seems to start with the first exegetical assumptions in texts very much at the same time as texts also begin to appear in tombs at the end of the 4th and through the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. If, as I hold, the vision of an ideal text is modeled upon divinatory texts, then the basic exegetical assumptions are also taken from the realm of divinatory hermeneutics. I will thus define ideal texts accordingly as texts that convey messages that are believed to be basically true. They are, however, difficult to read, since they employ an obscure language, the meaning of which is hidden, and so on and so forth. It has, therefore, to be commented. Significant text passages that convey meaning are mainly detected as deviations from strictly defined patterns of compositional regularities. They are mainly interpreted on the basis of analogies that are either connected through formal or through correlative equivalences. They are produced by authors which possess authority due to their superior knowledge, like Kongzi, or the wise, so the sage emperors in the Shangshu, which can provide advice and guidance to those who seek for it. The relationship between meaning and text in these ideal texts is not mediated by an authorial intention. The authorial act of expressing a hidden meaning thus does not follow an intention, but is a direct and choiceless mirroring of the truth of which they possess knowledge. So the author is very much like a heavenly author. The relationship is therefore what I want to call a physiognomical one. This means that the expression is not mediated by an intention, but immediately reveals the truth of something otherwise invisible. It is the access, again, to the superior knowledge of the sage authors that makes ideal texts as mediators of this knowledge so relevant to humans, because this superior knowledge helps them to arrive at decisions that alter their fates towards the better. I would like to shortly go through the text, 5 minutes, 1 minute per classic, to show you some of the features. Now I would like to illustrate that. I start with the Shangshu, which is the exception, because we don't have a very early exegetical tradition. We don't have a very early commentary to the Shangshu. The Shangshu stands sort of by its own, and does not really fit into my scheme of mantic commentaries. And this is why I would like to start with it. No early exegetical tradition could be found that makes use of divinatory hermeneutics. We do see combinations of diverse divinatory exegetical methods in later Han times, Shu exegesis. It seems, however, that these have been borrowed from the exegetical traditions of the other classics and have not been developed from a genuine tradition of Shu exegesis. My hypothesis in regard to this exception is that the Shangshu has strong features of what we have identified as prophetic traditions above. I cannot help but to now just put it on the other side then, and to try what happens, perhaps, to if we try to see it as belonging to prophetic category. The text has not been fixed and commented, but rather it has been rewritten until rather late. So this seems to coincide with what we know from prophetic traditions. The earliest layer of commentary, therefore, lies in its later or rewritten parts, which have to be read as interpretation of earlier parts. So we have this very old controversy about the old and new text chapters of the Shangshu and about the dating of the Shangshu, which is very, very unclear. So it might be that we indeed here have a tradition of rewriting instead of commenting upon a fixed text, which as a text has meaning in itself. It's more a report on what happens. I mean, there are kingly speeches, and you could think that these are authoritative, but there's no intent to look at this as a fixed form which should be commented upon in early times. But it seems to be not encoded, but it seems to clearly says what it means, so there no problem occurs which would need to read it otherwise. Now, the I Ching might be the most obvious text, of course, which is a divination text by itself. I don't have to talk about this and the commentaries, although we have commentaries who try to read it in a moral sense. The commentaries looking at it as a divinatory text have been continuing until very late, as Michael Lackner has shown. Right? Now, I have presented my argument that Chunqiu interpretation of the Gongyan Zhuan is based on a divinatory methodology in earlier publications in great detail, so I don't have to do that here again. We have done that in a reading session. The basic idea is that the Chunqiu is written in a perspective of pattern and deviation. The Chunqiu is written in a certain pattern, like the natural world follows certain patterns, and decisive and relevant are only the parts in the Chunqiu which deviate from this pattern. So we have a chronicle, and it follows the chronicle form, very dull, very always the same. So it establishes itself a certain pattern, and once the pattern is broken, the commentary comes in and asks, why is the pattern broken here? So this is like a comet or an omen which appears in the text, and this is relevant, and this is what then the commentaries try to explain. So this very much follows, indeed, a sort of exegesis, a divinatory exegesis of pattern and deviation, and of a message which is provided through deviation rather than through formal deviation rather than through the contents. If we look at Shi Jing interpretations, we find that they are throughout all the different also early traditions read as allegories for mental, emotional, and moral states. The Kunze Shilun, which is a very early manuscript from the early 2nd century BCE, was excavated from a tomb So is really an old text, even goes a step further and groups certain classes of poems together as pointing to similar issues. The poems are translated into their real meaning. They are taken as signs that point to something else, just like omina, as visual or oral signs that mean something else, are often designated as allegories. Ed Shaughnessy has discovered the divinatory structure of protasis and apodosis in the rhymed couplets of the Shijing. I would like to show that to you, because it's interesting that some of its poems, in fact, derive from divinatory oracles. Right? So this is we have here. This is what happens, and there are analogies of what this bird does in a nest, and what this is a raven song, and what the girl does when she goes into the house of her husband, because girls would go into the household of their husbands. And then we have all these analogies here, and Shaughnessy would argue that these perhaps were kind of Roman texts, which would give a certain situation in nature which corresponds to certain things in the human world, as an explanation, and that this, like in the omen lists, would point towards some evidence in the natural world which can be read as a certain consequence in the human world. I'm not so sure, because we don't really have different cases here, but they are very parallel, right? So it's more a repetition of a certain ritual, perhaps, rather than going through different classes of omens which would predict different outcomes, that we have positive and negative things, for example, grouped together, but we normally always have very similar things. Turning to the ritual classics, we have very similar way of the induction of general moralistic principles and closed set of principles from the descriptions of ritual practices, right? So in a very similar way. And what is interesting is that these principles are introduced by the ritual text itself, and that then in commentarial ritual texts, and I would view the Liji chapters as commentaries to the Ili, as many people do, you can see really different developments of how the rituals are explained and how more and more principles are established to translate the rituals into something else, so that there are signs for something else, that they stand for something else, and transform from ritual practice into moral values. Now I think I should stop here, perhaps with a short conclusion. Boucher Leclerc demonstrates in this Histoire de la Divination dans l'Antiquité how floating the borders between exegesis and divinatory science and exegesis of divine books were in ancient Greece. Talking about divinatory texts, the distinction between provoked or non-provoked heavenly signs, revealed books, inspired prophecies, and the wise chrismoi of the oracle chanters can indeed be hardly drawn. A clear adoption of exegetical terminology and techniques can also be proven in traditions of prophetic texts starting from the 2nd century BCE in the Near East. Likewise, the canonical texts in early China were read as works not only dealt with, but also were expressions and embodiments of the heavenly order as it appears in the human world. Accordingly, the hermeneutics applied to some of these texts followed divinatory hermeneutics developed in diverse divinatory traditions. As the religious assumptions underlying divination methods became increasingly criticized in elite discourses, new authoritative institutions had to be invented that provided open spaces for regulated negotiations on social, economic, legal, political, and ethical matters. The classics were one of these institutions, and as a continuation of earlier divinatory institutions, they took over a number of features from this earlier practice. It is interesting that the two classics who are the latecomers to the canon, namely the Chuntyu and the I Ching, who only were part of the canon in the late second century, we do see the others earlier, are the two classics, the commentaries of which in the most obvious way employ divinatory reading techniques to decode them. As leading classics, they set the tone of canon exegesis in the early Han, when the canon of the five books was established as an imperial institution. We find a similar contradiction in both the biblical and the Confucian traditions, who both clearly reject divinatory practices and put forth an effort to erase all divinatory contents from their scripts. Yet, what they do employ are the divinatory techniques of interpretation, which allow them the flexibility to situate their texts in new contexts and adapt them to the pressing issues of their days. Having survived until today as powerful instruments of coping with the future, they must in a very specific way have managed to keep the open space that allows these devices to decision to hold up the tension which keeps them alive. Thank you very much.